Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy conference call series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We are delighted to have Joshua Kurlansik with us to talk about Myanmar's transition to democracy and the rise of interreligious violence across the country. Joshua Kurlansik is CFR's Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia. Prior to coming to CFR, he was a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Mr. Kurlansik has worked as a columnist for Time, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer for Mother Jones. He also serves on the editorial board of Current History and is the winner of the Luce Scholarship for Journalism in Asia. Mr. Kurlansik is a frequent contributor to the CFR blog Asia Unbound, and his most recent book, entitled Democracy in Retreat, was published in 2013. Welcome, Josh. Thank you very much for being with us. It would be great if you could begin by giving your analysis of Myanmar's efforts to transition to democracy and talk about the religious dynamic within the country.
Sure. Well, thanks, first of all, to everyone for joining the call. I think it reflects, you know, there really is quite unique interest in Myanmar or Burma. I use these terms interchangeably. This is, you know, an interest that actually surpasses interest in most of the other countries in the region that I cover. So I'm happy to talk about this. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about Myanmar's reform process, going back to the reforms that began in 2010, and then I'll talk about some of the serious challenges, which the most serious is the breakdown of security due to tensions primarily between Muslims and Buddhists, but the overall security breakdown. And then I can give some very brief ideas on where Myanmar is going from here, and then I'd be happy to take questions or thoughts. I know some people have been in Myanmar recently. I get to go a couple of times a year. I'll be going again in about 6 weeks. And I was able to go last time I went to the western part of Myanmar, which is where the violence was concentrated, although it's now spread out somewhat to other parts of the country. So first of all, in many ways, the reforms since 2010 for people who know Myanmar have been really staggering. And you can see on the ground almost anywhere in the country, but particularly in central Myanmar, it's actually visible virtually everywhere in the country. And I do believe that the current government in Myanmar, which is sort of, I would say, a military-appointed, essentially, caretaker government before the 2015 elections, is serious about implementing political and economic reform. And the current president, Thein Sein, has announced that he's not going to stand for the 2015 elections, giving him, in many ways, more incentive to push serious reform since he has no political position to protect. And I do think that they are serious. And from being one of the most really the most repressive and isolated places in the world, short of North Korea, Myanmar today is actually has moved beyond politically beyond many of its near neighbors. If you go there, you'll see a very vibrant civil society has emerged. The press is blossoming. There's so many new print newspapers, online discourse, which I will get to a little bit, has its downside, but it's staggeringly free compared to only a few years ago. Parliament, which many people assume was just going to be a rubber stamp, has become a place where there's real discussion and debate on legislation. The National League for Democracy, which is Aung San Suu Kyi's party, which was basically banned and battered and brought to almost nothing for 2 decades, is legal now. It's flourishing. It has a young generation of members who are modernizing the party. And the economic environment has begun to open up as well, which has allowed a new influx of investment from most of the countries that until recently had sanctions on Myanmar, including us, although U.S. companies have probably been the most hesitant of any multinationals to invest in Myanmar. But the Japanese, the Europeans, the Australians, the British, and some U.S. companies have seen Myanmar as a possible golden opportunity, and there has been significant growth in investment in the last few years. And all of these reforms are designed to lead up to national elections in 2015, which would, in theory, if they go off well and are free and fair, would set the stage for a transition to what would probably be a government led by Suu Kyi's party, which is, for people who followed Myanmar, would 4 or 5 years ago have really been striking, shocking. If that was a successful transition, I think you would see basically the remnants of Myanmar being a pariah state in the world, which are being dismantled already, would be completely dismantled. You'd see the U.S. and other democracies remove whatever remaining restrictions on investment or trade, probably military and political relations with Myanmar that still exist. So in many ways, you know, a breathtaking change in Myanmar. And certainly if you look at sort of the top-line coverage of Myanmar the last few years, what you'll mostly see is coverage of this breathtaking change. But there is a very serious undercurrent. The opening has unleashed really powerful forces in Myanmar that are seriously threatening stability. I think that although people could have expected that you take the cap off a place that was under probably the second most repressive government in the world, that it's unfair to expect that it's going to turn into Switzerland overnight. I think the level of instability and the forces that have been unleashed really are quite striking. This is a country that has had a long history of xenophobia, of ethnic and religious tension. And there was some history of anti-Muslim violence, anti-Muslim attacks going back 50, 100 years, as well as attacks on ethnic Chinese, ethnic Indians. But over the last 2 years, things have spiraled well beyond previous Buddhist-Muslim tensions in Myanmar. 2 years ago, it started in western Myanmar, in Arakan or Rakhine State. And at first, the tensions were, I think, in many ways, they were conflating religion and nationality, because the contestation there by many Buddhists, many Arakan Buddhists, is that many of the Muslims who live in that area, the Rohingya Muslims, are not Burmese, that they are Bengali migrants. Now, I don't agree with that, but in that way, nationality and religion was conflated, and you had seemingly out of nowhere, although I'm happy to talk about why it wasn't out of nowhere, a series of attacks 2 years ago that built up, have resulted in the devastation of much of the Muslim community in western Myanmar, displaced more than 100,000 people, almost all of whom were Muslims, had led to a lot of land grabbing, an unknown death toll. Now, in the last year or so, that violence, which had previously been mostly confined to western Myanmar, has now spread all over the country. So you've had attacks by Buddhist vigilante groups, Buddhist paramilitary groups on Muslims virtually everywhere, but certainly in the outskirts of Yangon, the biggest city, in Mandalay, in the northeast, in other places. I would say that from my time there, no Muslims in Myanmar, I think, now feel completely safe that the violence is not going to touch them. And so this growing climate of insecurity has also led to some degree, a response in which some Muslim groups in the country have also fought back, created their own, I don't want to say armed, because that has the wrong connotation, but their own vigilante groups to strike back. And you now have a cycle of violence that has perpetuated itself in many parts of the country, often with the police and the army, at the very least, doing nothing, and sometimes actively participating with paramilitary groups. And many of Myanmar's neighbors, India, Thailand, Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, have been affected. There have been several killings of Buddhists in Malaysia, in the large Myanmar migrant community there. There have been attempted bombings of the Myanmar embassy in Indonesia, allegedly by groups that wanted to protest the attacks on Muslims in Myanmar. So everyone in the region is understandably worried about this violence spiraling into an even greater powder keg. There have been some efforts from the outside to both monitor and offer some strategies for reconciliation. I would say, in my opinion, so far they've been mostly unsuccessful, largely because hardline Buddhist/nationalist groups in Myanmar have opposed them. So, for example, representatives from the Organization of the Islamic Conference have on several occasions, including last week, tried to visit Myanmar and do some fact-finding. They were basically locals in places where they went refused to let them see anything. So similar efforts by other religious organizations, including Muslim groups from around Southeast Asia, have really not met with a very warm response overall in Myanmar. So the outside world so far, although I think there have been some efforts, has done relatively little in trying to mediate the religious tensions, although the outside world is increasingly becoming a player in aid in Myanmar. So you have a sort of bifurcated situation. You have, on the one hand, really staggering reforms, political, economic, civil society reforms that are setting the stage for a really impressive democratic change. On the other hand, this freedom, which also has come with flourishing of online hate speech, people using the New Freedoms of Association to organize themselves into paramilitary groups. Overall, the New Freedoms have led to an almost pre-Yugoslavia civil wars environment in which Myanmar is becoming an increasingly divided sectarian society with less and less to hold together. So you have a very dangerous situation here. And I'll finish this part and then offer just a couple of ideas about what one can do. I think adding to the danger is the fact that many of the most prominent voices in Myanmar that have long advocated for peace and inter-ethnic, inter-religious conciliation have been strangely quiet on this situation. Aung San Suu Kyi has made some comments about Buddhist-Muslim tensions, but she has really disappointed, I think, many people both in Myanmar and the outside world by her lack of a strong stance on, that Muslims are full citizens of Myanmar, and B, that the government and civil society and she herself should take some role in helping to mediate tensions. And other prominent civil society voices from Suu Kyi on down, as well as those in the government, I would say actually the president has done an okay job, but others in the government have also been relatively quiet in standing up for the idea that Myanmar is a country where people of all different religions can be citizens. So for me personally, it's a very disappointing time for Aung San Suu Kyi, despite her freedom and her traveling the world to receive many laurels. So where can Myanmar go from here? I'm happy to take questions. Some of the things that I've suggested, and other people have suggested, that Myanmar is going to need to look to at least get a grip on the insecurity is, Suu Kyi, the president, and others are going to have to come out and take a strong stand against the vigilante groups, which are largely responsible, mostly Buddhist vigilante groups, largely responsible for the breakdown in law and order. The security forces, the police, the military are going to need to take a larger role as well. They've done little in the ways of stopping attacks or prosecuting offenders. And in the long run, Myanmar is going to have to come up with some sort of new idea of what it means to be a Myanmar citizen, a new concept of what Myanmar is as a country, one that is probably going to have to be more federal and more inclusive, so that people of different religions and different ethnicities can fit themselves into the idea of what it means to be a Myanmar citizen. Right now, that concept of a more federal and inclusive Myanmar is still a very hot potato. And in the run-up to Myanmar's 2015 elections, even someone as esteemed and famous as Suu Kyi is reluctant to touch it. So you have kind of the opening of politics playing in some ways a negative role for creating a Myanmar that can have more than just Buddhist or Buddhist Burmar citizens. I think I'll stop there. I'm sorry to sound a negative note. It may come as a contrast to what you hear about Myanmar, but that's the way I see it.
Thanks, Josh, very much. Let's open it up to the group for questions and comments.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch tone phone now. Questions will be answered in the order they are received. Again, that is star one to ask a question. We are currently holding for questions. Our first question comes from Adam Carroll with Burma Task Force USA.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Hello?
Oh,
great. Thanks for your overall presentation, and I appreciate especially your addressing the disappointment in Suu Kyi. I had a question, two sort of questions. One is, given the injustice of the land grabbing and the role of profit in the village burnings, and the circumstantial evidence that the government and or military are involved in the violence and the spread of paramilitaries, how do you see U.S. Response at the embassy level in Yangon, and overall, what would you suggest in terms of pushing a human rights agenda and not just investment? I guess that's it. My group is a group of Muslim American organizations, and we speak for them on this issue. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for the question. Well, I'll say a couple of things. First of all, government in Myanmar, just like government in the United States, means many different things. So in terms of the government being involved both in land grabbing and security forces not necessarily doing anything to stop violence, I don't think that at the highest levels in the area, in the level of the government around President Thein Sein, that you have people who are actively interested in encouraging the violence. I think that at other levels of the government, there probably are people. And I think also that one of the challenges that the president of Myanmar has today is that although Myanmar was an authoritarian country, he actually is not as powerful as many leaders, not only of authoritarian countries, but of many democratic countries, because there are still so many vestiges of the old system left in place. It's unclear whether he even has control of his regional commanders or security forces on the ground. So I want to just differentiate between government, and government. Secondly, in terms of the U.S. response, the first thing I would say is that at this point, and I will get to some suggestions, the U.S. is a very minor player in Myanmar. U.S. aid is nothing compared to, for example, the assistance provided to Myanmar by Japan, the Europeans, China. U.S. investment is nothing compared to that of the Singaporeans, the Chinese, the Thais, the Japanese, etc. The U.S. has some role as a kind of moral beacon in Myanmar, I would say, partly because Myanmar sort of has been dropped in from a sort of Cold War environment in which many of the issues that people have soured on the U.S. around the world the last 10 years kind of were ignored in Myanmar. So you still have kind of a view of the U.S. as the way that the U.S. was often viewed in Eastern Europe or in the Soviet Union in the 80s. So the U.S. has an important role to play there. I think it's important not to overstate it. It's still a pretty small role. That said, First of all, I think that the administration is moving far too quickly on military and military cooperation with Myanmar, which is advocated by Derek Mitchell, who I'm a big fan of, but I think that military cooperation at the level that we're proceeding is far too rapid. The Myanmar military needs to first work on downsizing the military and placing more power for enforcement of crime and crowd police. And if we want to spend our money on the Myanmar security forces, it would be more wisely used building up an effective civilian police force, which is something we've helped do in Cambodia with some success, in Indonesia with a fair amount of success. And other donors also, I think, the Australians, for example, are definitely interested in spending their money on a police force. So that would be one. Second, in terms of promoting human rights rather than agenda rather than just investment, I don't think that the embassy, other than this focus on nil-nil, is ignoring human rights, and certainly Congress is not ignoring human rights. Human rights still are a major component of our bilateral relationship, but I think it's important as the relationship progresses to keep human rights as part of every component of the bilateral dialogue. So as we move forward with some type of nil-nil cooperation, we're going to need to continue to make human rights part of that dialogue. In terms of land grabbing specifically, I think there's actually very little the U.S. Embassy can do about that. The role is more for activist groups that have some power or investors in to point out the factors that are involved in land grabbing is one of them. However, I'll just end by saying, I'm afraid to say that a lot of the land grabbing that's gone on in Western Myanmar and that is responsible for some of this violence is land grabbing for land that is probably then going to be sold to China or Thai companies. And I think that the amount of leverage anyone has over many of those companies is very limited. And I'll stop there.
Thanks, Josh. Next question.
Our next question comes from Ms. Ruth Messenger with American Jewish World Service.
First of all, thank you very much for doing this call, and thank you for that presentation. I only felt positive about it because I was just there. American Jewish World Service has had a universe of grassroots partners, mostly dealing with land rights and human rights for over 10 years, and I was visiting a lot of them and came to some of the same conclusions and felt like maybe I was out of my mind because the mindset is so much on the surface. Everything is great. We're a democracy. One of my major questions was about the U.S. role, which you just addressed at some length. So let me just ask two other shorter questions. One is people kept telling us that although a federated structure was the right direction to go, which I heard you mention, there was no possibility of constitutional or charter change that would move in that direction because there aren't enough, the way the government is currently structured, there aren't enough votes to make that switch. So I just wondered if you agreed with that take. And the other thing, which is a much longer question, Josh, is can you say something about, I loved your formulation about the opening up of the country, releasing some longer stewing tensions between Buddhists and Muslims. But can you say a little bit more about where those tensions come from other than the ordinary?
Sure. Okay, to the first question, the government that exists in Myanmar now is sort of semi-legitimate. It was quote-unquote elected in an election in 2010 that was not really a free and fair election, and it happens to have moved forward and become more legitimate in some ways by pursuing relatively open policies and winning more trust from people. But there's going to be a national election in 2015, and presumably, unless something completely goes off the rails, that election is going to be won with an enormous majority by the National League for Democracy. And depending how the Constitution is changed, because they have this provision that was written solely so that Suu Kyi couldn't be the president, where you can't be the president if you are or were married to a foreigner. If that's changed, then probably Suu Kyi will be the president commanding an enormous majority in parliament. So at that time, it would be possible to have constitutional change, to sit down and rewrite the constitution. That would be the time to do it, if there was any time. So if they pass on that opportunity, That to me would be a major mistake. But if people are telling you that there's no possibility to do it before then, before the 2015 elections, that's probably true. I mean, also the government right now has so many issues, and they're not really a completely legitimate government. They probably don't want to set down a constitutional convention. But in 2015, if you have a truly elected government with a massive majority, then that would be the time. As to the second, where do the Buddhist-Muslim tensions arise from in Myanmar? Well, there are a lot of answers to that, but certainly going back to the post-colonial days, there's always been a strand of anti-Muslim sentiment in some of the more extreme Buddhist monasteries around the country. And over the last 15 years, many of the monasteries were essentially forced to take in larger sectors of society because they had become some of the only places where people could get fed regularly, where they could study. And so you had monasteries that were overflowing. Now, in the last few years, going back about 10 years, there was, encouraged by the previous military regime, a very strong strand of sort of Sri Lankan-type hardline Buddhist movements within some of the monasteries, including which gave rise to some of the hardline leaders who you may have heard of when you're in Myanmar. Like the most famous one, his name is Wiratu, and he's very much a Sri Lankan-style nationalist. And many of those young men were groomed in the 90s and the early 2000s by the military regime in monasteries and were made part of a sort of nationwide paramilitary organization that was used to help keep the military regime in power, used to attack the NLD, et cetera. Now the country opens up, but that network of paramilitaries and nationalist Buddhists who grew up during that time, they haven't gone away. But at the same time, not that it's bad that it's become a democracy, but with the creation of a democracy, the government has less ability to control those groups. So they have, and combined with that, the internet and the wider distribution of phones and DVDs have allowed some of the really charismatic of these nationalist leaders to really propagate their message around the country. So you have a whole sort of confluence of circumstances that has allowed the more hardline Buddhist groups, and now has allowed them to really get their message around the country. The answer, the question of, well, why has their message resonated so much, that is a question I think is very hard for me to answer and would be better answered by someone who could give you an anthropological answer. But I think that certainly Burma is a society in which it's still very poor. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with the pace of change, despite the fact that it is changing. You have people in very difficult circumstances and a climate of hatred that was fostered and kept simmering for decades and now opened up some of that hatred, much of it against Muslims, but some against other ethnic groups too. It's just exploded.
Very helpful. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Ruth. Next question. Summer, next question.
Our next question comes from Scott Flips with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
Hi, this is Scott Flips. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I've been to Burma myself, as everyone seems to be, in the last couple months, twice now, and was able to go to Chin State, Kachin State, Mon State, among other places. And I think that your pessimism, both with the note that remarkable things are happening, is the exactly right note, I think, to hit. Because everybody that I talk to, and it's obviously colored by the fact that my meetings are with Muslims and it's with Christians and ethnic minorities and Rohingya. But everyone I talk to said, the first thing they say is nothing's changed. Even though remarkable things have changed, they all say nothing's changed, but we don't want the military to ever come back. And so there's sort of a notion that they don't think the changes are real or that they're going to last. That's the first thing from one group. The other side, I think there's a fear as well that things are going to change. I mean, that the things aren't going to sort of move in the right direction. But there's also, as you pointed out, this deep loathing, I think, when I sat down with Wiratu and with some of the other monks, including Ashin Thiri, I mean, the sort of loathing, not just of Muslims, but of also ethnic minorities and Christians that they expressed very openly, I think also colors the prospects for not only dealing with Rohingya citizenship issues, but also dealing with a federal system. They believe that they have allies, and they told me they had allies in the military who won't let, you know, democracy flourish, or won't let, in particular, in a place like Chin State, you know, Christian Chin to take control of the province. So I think these things are, as you point out, are deep, deep challenges, political challenges, which I'm not sure can be, sort of taken over or addressed in 2015. So, stop my commenting. I've got a couple questions. Yesterday, there was a story, to go back to some of the articles that were sent around, yesterday there was a story of a couple Rakhine men who were arrested in Yangon with bombs that they were planning to blow up mosques and other sites in Yangon. And the story now is that they received training and materials to do this. So I wondered if you had thought that this maybe the sort of bombings are morphing into, another direction where there are forces that are out there encouraging these type of things, where it's not the large-scale mob violence, but it's these small-scale things that are often very destructive. Secondly, you mentioned Yugoslavia as a model, and I think if diplomats believe that Burma was going to turn into a Yugoslavia, that sort of colors, I think, everything that they would do. But when I talk to diplomats, including U.S. and British and EU and Japanese, I mean, they think more in terms of Indonesia's transition, where there was massive sectarian violence at the beginning, but no one thinks now, even though there continues to be major problems, sort of inter-religious problems, that no one thinks that Indonesia isn't going to have a successful election in 2014, where if Joko Widodo is elected, everything's going to be great. So, I mean, again, that model sort of shapes policy, I think, in a sense of what is the priorities. Third, on the Rohingya issue, our commission, and I think you have written as well about the refugee issues that I think are apparent in Southeast Asia, and I think you've recommended, and we've recommended, sort of third country sort of refuge in a temporary sense and beefing that type of stuff up. But I've kind of become, I'm not so sure that that's the best approach at the moment, mostly because I think it gives Burmese an excuse if we beef up sort of third country, you know, protections and refugee camps and other things, that it gives Burmese an excuse to say, look, the world community actually believes that they're not part of us, and we won't take them back once they leave. They got to go someplace else. So those are the three. I think those are big questions, but those are the questions that I came up with at the moment, and I'll listen to your answer.
Okay, thanks. I'm not sure what your question is about. Do I think that third country resettlement is a good idea? Is that?
Yeah, do you still think that that's beefing up?
Well,
that
I think that in this emergency situation, I think that the camps that are set up in Arakansti are totally unsuitable, and that right now I don't think the prospects of someone being resettled in Arakansti, at least, is a very good one. If those camps were brought to international standard and groups like MSF and others were allowed to operate completely unfettered, it might be a different story. But I think at this point, maybe things will be different in a few years. Trying to resettle people in Arakansti doesn't mean that I don't think there should be punishment for the violence, but trying to resettle people or even putting people in those camps is just, to me, is an inadequate situation. And I think that as long as the camps and the resettlement options in Myanmar are so dire that I think that you could be sending the wrong message, but I think it's keeping people in Arakan state who are possibly going to be run down and attacked again is a hard call to make. As to the second question, I don't know. I haven't really taken a survey of the diplomatic community in Yangon, but remember that most of the Western countries, so not Japan, but most of the Western countries had very limited embassy staff in Yangon until a couple of years ago. And so it's not like you have a huge number of people with an enormous amount of experience in Myanmar. So I'm not sure how much their policy prescriptions are being based on long knowledge of Myanmar. I do think that in the U.S., there is quite a high, in Congress at least, and among policymakers, there is quite a high degree of understanding that human rights remains a serious challenge in Myanmar. I don't think people are just wiping it under the table, but in terms of the diplomatic community and whether they think it's going to turn into Indonesia or Yugoslavia, I don't know. I know that many Indonesian diplomats think that Myanmar is not likely to turn into Indonesia, but I don't know what all the others think. I mean, certainly for some of these other countries, much more so than the U.S., actually, for Japan, for example, Myanmar is a very, very important potential strategic ally, and that's why Japan is pouring money in. And so the pressure there to come up with a good interpretation of what's happening is actually much greater than it would be for Derek Mitchell. So, I think you have to take that into consideration, too.
Thank you. Next question.
There's one more question about the bombings.
Oh, the bombings. I don't know really what to say about that. I mean, there have actually been other bombings earlier this year, although the government blamed them on Kachin, who were trying to deter foreign investment. There were some small bombings last year. There were quite a few random small bombings all over the country, even in the time of military rule. I don't know if they portend more organization. I mean, if you look at some of the attacks, even going back into Arakan State, and certainly some of the attacks outside of Arakan State, there already is a fairly high degree of organization in some of the attacks. It seems like a mob shows up, but really the mob comes in and within a short amount of time, they have like earth moving equipment and stuff. So
yeah.
I think in some of these instances already people have a high degree of organization. So I'm not sure if making and planting a bomb is more or less organization than that was already.
Okay. Thanks. Let's go to the next question or comment. And may I ask that people limit to one question or comment because we have about 15 in queue and only 20 minutes left, or actually 15 minutes left to go. So we want to try to get to as many of you as possible.
Our next question comes from Donovan Herbert with the Episcopal Church.
Thank you very much for what you've said.
Thank you.
Herb, are you there? I think his line, he might have disconnected.
Yes, our next question comes from David Saperstein with Religious Action Center.
Hi, this is Deborah. David had to step away for a pastoral call. He was wondering if there are responsible religious leaders who are trying to diffuse the tensions and who they are in the region and what activities they're engaged in to try and be a part of this process.
Well, certainly there are responsible religious leaders in Myanmar. There's quite a few more moderate Buddhist leaders who have denounced the rhetoric of the more extreme monks and have denounced the paramilitary groups quite bravely because, you know, it's hard to denounce, to be the voice for moderation in such a difficult time. There are certainly quite a few moderate Muslim leaders in Myanmar, too. Overall, I would say the Muslim community in Myanmar has primarily been one, I should say in Christians, yeah, it's been primarily one that's been victimized in the last 3 years. But, yes, definitely there have been quite vocal Buddhist leaders in the region as well, too. There have been several visits and efforts by regional Buddhist and Muslim leaders to come together in Yangon and call for moderation. The problem, like I said, is less that sort of what I would say is like sort of like mid-level religious and civil society leaders aren't there. The problem is that the people with the most moral authority, the most prominent monks, but also Suu Kyi, haven't really been vocal about it. So there has been some attention paid, you know, in the Myanmar media to the more moderate groups, but it's hard for them to compete with the fiery rhetoric. And when the big, the most prominent civil society leaders are quiet, then the more sort of middle level religious and civil society leaders wonder, what's the message being sent down? Should I stick my neck out here?
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Jennifer Bryson with Witherspoon Institute.
Hi, thanks for this addressing this important topic. And since my question has been answered already, I just have a quick comment on the issue of military cooperation between the U.S. and Myanmar, Burma, is that I think it's really important to differentiate between providing equipment on the one hand, and on the other, the military cooperation that involves personnel. Because our military cooperation that involves personnel, such as training opportunities, educational opportunities, relationship building, can be one of the best mechanisms possible for reform and helping countries develop militaries. So I think it's important to differentiate if we're looking towards constructive reform.
I guess I would have to disagree with that, I'm sorry to say. I think that that could, in theory, be true, but my own experience from Southeast Asia suggests to me that years of interactions and education programs with some of the other regions' militaries have not promoted that type of positive culture that we seek to promote. So, for example, with the Thai military, with which we've long had the type of educational exchanges and much more, I don't think that it's been really very effective. And for now, it's one of the sticks that we're able to use with Myanmar government while we've also deployed a lot of carrots. And so I just see the possibility of greater mil-mil interaction as one that should be not moved on very quickly. And I don't honestly have seen a lot of places where mil-mil personnel interaction, at least in Southeast Asia, and particularly with militaries who have had as terrible rights records as Myanmar military, has really made a huge difference.
Okay.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Reverend Paul Rutgers with the Council of Religious Leaders of Metropolitan Chicago.
Yes, thank you. It's very easy to hear the description of what's going on at this point as one more religious war or religion against religion. Part of my question is already started to be dealt with. Arguably, there is nothing inherent in either Buddhism or Islam that brings this conflict to a head. And it's good to hear that there are at least some voices from within the faith communities who are apparently arguing this. But there must be deeper causes, deeper reasons for this terrible hostility that goes beyond and outside of the religious identification per se. And any further comment on that, insight into that, would be appreciated.
Sure. I mean, I don't want to talk too in depth about what is the nature of Buddhism or Islam, because that's now getting way outside my realm, and people know more than me. But yeah, certainly, what you have is in Myanmar primarily Buddhism being intertwined with Burman or Bamar nationalism, being intertwined with just grievances created by years of repression, a still weak economy, monasteries, like I said, overflowing with sort of unemployed people, the years of the ostracism of the other in all forms by military government, and then the sort of opening up of the internet rapidly, which has allowed the loudest and angriest voices to proliferate as it does in some other places. And all these things have sort of combined to be channeled through several charismatic monks into sort of vicious ideology and attacks. But as to what, how much of that is, or at all, is related to what actually Buddhism is, you know, is way beyond my realm. But certainly, there's a whole lot of socioeconomic factors that the lid has been blown off of alone, and this is a channel for them to be expressed.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Ralston Deffenbaugh with Lutheran World Federation.
Thank you very much. My question is, I'm wondering if the Buddhist militancy against the Muslims will also play out against some of the ethnic groups in neighboring province or neighboring states, many of whom are Christian.
Well, there's already, I mean, there already has been in Myanmar, going back almost to the days after independence, there were long-time wars in most of the ethnic minority areas, so there's been a long history of conflict. Peace deals have been signed in many of those areas, although some of those have not held up, in the Kachin area. I think that because there was already such a history of inter-ethnic tensions, didn't have too far to go down. I don't actually think that, I think it's harder for extreme Buddhist Burman nationalists like the monk we're out to demonize Christians in such an extreme way, although certainly they do. There are more prominent Christians who wield power in Myanmar than there are Muslims, and extreme criticism and violence against Christians in central Myanmar, the way there has been against Muslims, I think will be more challenging for extreme Buddhists to get away with. But certainly, I mean, you have a very unstable climate, so it will be hard to rule out anything from happening.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Rochelle Wiseman with Lacuna Group.
Hi, yes, thank you as well for your presentation. My question is, there are large companies in Myanmar. Some are American, for instance, Coca-Cola is in there. Do you see any role for large companies to play in terms of having any leverage with the government or on the ground through community engagement to make a difference?
I think there, first of all, again, big American companies are still very small players in Myanmar compared to other major players. So the people who have the most power is Japanese, Chinese state companies, the Singaporeans, the Thais. I don't know how much any of them really care about anything other than stability. I think there's a role to play, but, you know, I think Myanmar needs a basic level of security and a political system that can work for everyone and a capable administration. And, you know, those aren't things that multinational companies can, you know, apply pressure for. I mean, I think on a basic level of, you know, we don't want Pepsi to be taking over land that to be used to farm sugar that people have been thrown off of, which is something they've been accused of doing in Cambodia. So a basic level of upholding human rights, I think there's a role to play. But Myanmar's challenges are challenges of law and order, of administration, and of political reform that are pretty far removed from the operations of multinational companies.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Mara Gutenplan with Jacob Boston Institute.
Hi, thank you. On in your remarks that reforms since 2010 have been really staggering, particularly in central Burma. I've worked on Burma for several years, and you know, I agree that the climate certainly improved, but there are extensive ongoing human rights violations that are occurring and that are affecting not just the Muslim minority and the Rohingya And I think that this was confirmed by recent reports of the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Burma and the consensus resolution that was passed by the UN General Assembly Third Committee yesterday. So I just want to hold that as a basic comment. You know, one great example is that although many, many political prisoners have been released, they're often released conditionally and can be rearrested and put back in prison. And, you know, famous political prisoners such as Ugambira have experienced this situation. There are also ongoing harassment and arrests of human rights defenders throughout the country. You spoke a little bit about constitutional reform, and I think this is an important matter as well as the elections that will be coming up in 2015. You said that you think that the National League for Democracy will come into power and at that point hopefully be able to reform the Constitution. My understanding is that they currently hold about 10% of seats in Parliament, and that to amend the Constitution, you need approval of 75% of both houses, while 25% is reserved for military. So I was hoping you could expand a little bit more on that, on how you expect the NLD portion in Parliament to go from 10% up to 75% or onwards. You know, I think that probably other opposition parties and ethnic minority parties will want to carve out a larger chunk of the Parliament for themselves, and how that will affect constitutional reforms and other changes going forward.
Okay, well, the NLD only has 10% because that was basically from a by-election, which they won every seat except one. I think that if you look back at the 1990 results or at the by-election, it suggests that when all the seats are up, the NLD and potentially their ethnic minority allies are going to win a staggering percentage of the seats. I don't think there's any reason so far to doubt that. So they have 10%, but they won, like, I have to go back and look, but it was like 92 out of 93 seats that they contested or something like that. So I think that they're likely to control an enormous amount. The percentage reserved for the military is up. It's also going to be up for debate and depends largely on what the military is going to agree to. I think that if the NLD is smart, they're going to make some alliances with some of the ethnic minority parties too, but my feeling is that they're going to have an enormous mandate, far beyond what one would see in any Western democracy. And my point, I'm not saying that they will do this. I really don't know. My point is simply that there's no better, there's not going to be any better time than that. But certainly it's not going to happen now, but I think that after 2015 is the best time, while the NLD and their allies presumably have an enormous mandate, and while Aung San Suu Kyi is still alive.
Thank you. We have time for one last question, and my apologies to all of you for having been able to go around the horn again. One last question, Summer.
Our next question comes from... Our next question comes
Udin? Wakar Udin?
Yes.
Dr. Wakar Udin from Arakan Rohingya Union?
Yeah, great. Right. And your question is? Yes. And your question is?
My question is that regarding the violence in Arakan State against Rohingya Muslim population, the fundamental issue there is whether these Rohingya are the indigenous ethnic population of that region or Bengali migrants, as Burmese government and Rakhine call it. I heard the gentleman has said earlier, use the word Bengali migrants. I don't know if that's his own term or he's quoting to the Myanmar government statements. And could you give your perspective whether these people are truly Bengali migrants or they are indigenous ethnic population of the region for many centuries, what history have time and again showed? Thank you.
Yeah, I said before that the dispute is a religious nationalist one in which many Arakan people believe the Rohingya are Bengali migrants, but I don't personally believe that.
So what is your take on why the Myanmar government and the Rakhine population is not yielding on that fundamental issue that they are not willing to accept the very ethnicity, very nativity of those people in our country.
Well, I think there's a combination of many issues, including a vacuum in security, rise of Buddhist paramilitaries, the realization by some in Arakan State that Arakan State is rich in natural resources, and in a time where investment is going to potentially pour into Myanmar, the land is potentially much more valuable, a history of tensions, a lack of control of paramilitaries by security forces or even an abetting of them, and a lack of high-level condemnation of the treatment of Rohingya from Suji. Tintin's somewhat, Tintin's been a little better, but other leaders on just below Suu Kyi on that kind of moral level.
Very quick question. If I may, Myanmar government seems to have softened their position a little bit lately about the Rohingya population. They are going to conduct verification, and they are not going to use the word Bengali, and reportedly they are leaving the form blank or letting them write the Rohingya. And what is your take on what is possibly coming in the future, the way Myanmar government is responding right now?
I really don't know. I mean, what the Myanmar government is right now, it's hard to know whether what the Myanmar government is going to be what the Myanmar government is in 2 years. Like I said, I think that Thein Sein's position has been relatively decent, and of all the political leaders, he has evolved towards a more moderate policy. But I don't think the Myanmar government is going to take any major steps anyway in the next 1.5 years.
Thank you very much. Josh, we appreciate your taking the time to be with us today, and to all of you for your terrific questions and comments. And we hope that you will read more of Josh Kurlansik's analysis on our website at www.cfr.org and follow his posts on the Asia Unbound blog, which also can be accessed from our homepage. This conference call series is part of CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, seeking to connect religious and congregational leaders and scholars from across the country in conversations on a broad range of pressing international issues. Any feedback or suggestions, please email us at outreach@cfr.org. And on a related note, if you will be at the American Academy of Religion annual meeting in Baltimore this weekend, we encourage you to visit us in the exhibition hall at booth number 253, and on Monday, November 25th, we will be hosting a luncheon conversation with Rachel Vogelstein and Ruth Messenger, who was on the call, on an ending child marriage. So we hope to see you there. If not, we look forward to your continued participation in this conference call initiative, and would welcome your feedback and comments. Josh, again, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank everyone for being interested.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.